All right. House Committee on Revenue for March 13, 2017 will come to order. Colleagues, we're going to hear first from Chris, who's going to bring us up with the history of the tax credits, especially transferable tax credits. And then we're going to open the public hearings on House Bill 2286 and 3032. Hopefully the rest of the committee will be here by that time. Chris?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So I'm going to be referring to a document in OLS called Tax Credit Transfers.
Okay.
So it's about a four-page document, but the last two pages are just statute there for reference purposes. And the idea here is to provide some orientation for freshman members and just a memory review for the veteran members on the issue of transferability. Where it fits in with the bills, House Bill 2286 tackles the larger issue of transferability. It establishes some uniform policies around that and then touches on all the tax credits that transfer. And then the second one, House Bill 3032, is more of a technical fix bill. But all of this is background and context for those two bills. So starting at the very beginning, I guess, the state currently has 56 tax credits that affect the revenue stream this biennium. And they are all listed in the 2017-19 tax expenditure report. Of those 56 tax credits, 31 of them are what I call active. And by active, I mean there can be a new claimant today. Somebody can do something to earn a credit or buy a credit this tax year. That's what I mean by active. And of those 31 tax credits, six of them are transferable in some form or another. Now, the policy considerations that get touched on as the legislature over the years has addressed transferability vary from tax credit to tax credit. But some of them I've listed here, and the first one I have is monetized multi-year tax credits. So tax credits, one way in looking at them, they come in two forms, multi-year tax credits or one-year tax credits. And most tax credits are one-year tax credits where a taxpayer does something or makes some sort of investment in a given year, and then they get a tax credit, and they get to claim that full amount of the tax credit on their tax return in the next year. The state does have several multi-year tax credits, and most of those tax credits are claimed over 5 years. So these would be investment-type tax credits where, say, 20% can be claimed in each of the subsequent 5 years. And often, because they are investment-related, the possibility of selling that tax credit and basically monetizing that stream of tax credits comes into play. So if I invest in something and I earn $1 million tax credit, if I want to sell that tax credit and take the equity I get and use that for investment in the project, that's one way or one reason for transferring. And doing that also, and one of the reasons for multi-year tax credits is that it spreads out the cost to the general fund of the tax credit. The second bullet point, extending the policy to tax-exempt entities, this came about with the energy tax credits, but it can apply to other tax credits as well. If the intent of the policy is to induce some sort of behavior in the private sector, tax credits generally only apply to entities that actually are taxable. They have to have some positive tax liability. Otherwise, the tax credit doesn't do them any good. But if the tax credit is extended to tax-exempt entities, then they need to sell the tax credit because they don't file a tax return, and it doesn't do them any good. So that's, if the policy desires to extend it to non-taxable entities, then transferability is one way to make that policy a bit more effective. So context is everything. The next bullet point here refers to refundable tax credits. And just so everybody recalls, a refundable tax credit is one in which a taxpayer does not need to have any positive liability. If I'm a taxpayer and I have my gross liability is $500 and I have a $900 tax credit, I first reduce my tax liability down to zero, and then I'll get a refund check for $400. That's another policy option instead of transferability. Again, that will primarily be applied or is applicable to entities that file a tax return. So that doesn't necessarily extend the policy to tax-exempt entities. But it is an option for taxable entities, the transferability versus the refundability. The last bullet point, policy structure, you'll see as we get to some of the other tax credits, it's inherent in the policy to make the tax credit transferable. For example, there is an affordable housing lender's tax credit where the tax credit is not sold like other tax credit, but they are tied to loans for affordable housing. And as everybody knows, these loans are often sold, so the tax credit follows the loan. So it's transferable in that sense. So then that gets us to the transfer price. So if the policy is agreed that a credit should be transferable, then there's the notion of the price, basically what somebody else, what a third party is going to pay for the tax credit. And here the options are the price is set by the state. We have some tax credits, mainly the energy tax credits, where the price is set in statute. It's not laid out in extensive detail, but there are broad strokes where the legislature has tasked the Department of Energy to come up with a formula for determining the price of the tax credits. Other tax credits, the prices are just determined by the stakeholders. The state isn't aware of what the price of the tax credit is, what one party pays another for it. Kind of a market price, if you will. And then the last piece I put in here is auctions. And depending on how you look at it, they're similar to transfers, but they are different. Auctions are when taxpayers, the Department of Revenue will hold a tax credit auction and they'll auction them off at, it's either $500 increments or $1,000 increments. And it's online and taxpayers can bid for those tax credits. And so that price is determined at auction. Generally, those tax credits can't then be sold to another taxpayer. So the third bullet point here is administration. And with most of these credits, you have two sides to the administration. You have the policy administrator, which is energy or housing. It's the state agency that will certify the tax credit because they're the ones with the policy expertise in housing, energy, economic development, what have you. But then the Department of Revenue plays a key role here because they administer the tax system. So there are a number of issues in aligning the policy that we're going to get to about pros and cons of having uniform policies around the tax credits. And I'm dividing that into two pieces because you can have uniformity for the information that comes to the Department of Revenue so that they can effectively administer the tax system. And that's basically, to be oversimplistic about it, the Department of Revenue getting a list of taxpayers who are eligible for a tax credit and the amount of tax credit that they can claim. The Department of Revenue just has to compare that information to the tax returns. They won't have any role in who is eligible for the tax credit. But that's one aspect to uniformity and the administration. And then the policy agencies, the issues get pretty complicated pretty quickly because the structures of the tax credits do vary, and those are vary for policy reasons. The table right here, we have the tax credit. These are the six active tax credits that are transferable in one form or another. So what I've done here is just list them and then listed the key language that the legislature has used to identify them as transferable. And they range from, for example, the biomass, a person may transfer the tax credit. So that's pretty simple. So there's not a lot of parameters on that. And conservation may transfer in exchange for a cash payment equal to the present value of the potential tax credit. So there, the state is weighing in on the price of that transfer. Transportation is similar to conservation, and the residential energy may be transferred to the first purchaser of a dwelling. This is mainly for contractors who install or build. And so if technically they earn the tax credit, but they are allowed to transfer it to the homeowner who's going to buy the home. but there aren't any details on the price of the tax credit. And then we get the agriculture workforce housing. An owner may transfer all or a portion of the credit. This is another example of a tax credit that gets used to raise some equity for the building of this housing. Mm-hmm. And then the affordable housing lender is really kind of the oddball. As I mentioned before, it's not transferred or sold on the market. It needs to be transferred because it is a function of the interest payments on the loan. And so that follows. So that one's a little bit of an oddball. And so where it's important.
And that's usually used, isn't it, to reduce the interest that the owner of the affordable housing has to pay the lender? Thinking of a different one?
It does, correct. If the market rate for a project is 6% on a loan, they can offer that loan at 2%, and they get the difference as a tax credit, and that savings is required to be passed on to the renters.
Right.
So it's kind of a voucher-like program where one entity is claiming the tax credit on their returns for the most part. They're going to be banks, financial institutions. They claim the tax credit. The value of the tax credit is really felt by the low-income renters in that housing.
Whose rent only has to pay for the 2% interest rate instead of the 6% interest rate.
Correct.
Along with the other expenses.
Right. Correct.
Okay.
So where it's helpful to keep in mind as you craft policy is if you intend for a transfer to be the same thing across tax credits, we're advised that the same language be used because the courts will often, if something comes to court, they may see differences in the way things are worded. If things are worded in one way in one place and differently in a different place, they may determine that the intent is different, and that may or may not be the case. So that leads us to some outstanding issues, and this is background largely for House Bill 3032. So the outstanding issue here are relate to the transfer bill transfer price of the energy tax credits. And since 2012, ODO, the Department of Energy, has had to set the transfer price. And as you may recall, in 2011 is when the business energy tax credit was ended and set apart into a few different tax credits that became known as the Energy Incentives Program. And with that program, energy was required to set the transfer price. And it was based on a formula, and it is required to be updated quarterly. And the guidance that the legislature provided in statute gave ODO admin authority to come up with the rule, but required them to include factors like inflation and the market real rate of return. And so as we transferred from the Business Energy Tax Credit Program to the Energy Incentives Program, this is where we've had a little bit of disconnect in the transfer price. Without getting into all of the nuances here, the basic information on the next table, for the business energy tax credits for 2007 through 2014, we have one-year tax credits and five-year tax credits that were sold. They were transferred. And this is basically a look at how the market, if you will, operated for those tax credits over those 8 years. And focusing on the one-year tax credits, we have the pass-through rate. That's the transfer price. I broke that out into four categories, basically less than 70% in the 70s, in the 80s, and then 90 and above. And for the one-year tax credits, we can see that the minimum price there, nothing was sold for less than 80% on the dollar. But if we look at that third line in the 80 to 89% group, the mode is 87%, meaning that's where most tax credits were sold. They were sold for 87%. And there were 3,084 of them, and the $13 million in tax credits were sold for $11 million. So the one-year tax credits, the prices were primarily in the 80s, some in the 90s. The table on the right there are the five-year tax credits. And these are the credits that a taxpayer would earn, but they could be claimed only over 5 years. I mean, they were spread out over 5 years. And here we can see that the predominant price is in the 70s. For the 70% to 70% to 79% group, the mode is 73%. And most of those credits sold for 73%. And there were just over 2,400 of them, 2,424. And those credits had a face value of $247 million, and they were sold for $181 million. Now, some of these tax credits were even sold for less than 70%. for those sold at less than 70%, the mode is 67%, meaning that's where most of them were sold. And I don't recall offhand what the lowest percent was. Some of these were sold even into the high 90s, but the majority of them, so the kind of the takeaway here is that one-year tax credits were sold at about 87%, and the five-year tax credits were sold at about 75% or 73%. So that's how it worked under the prior tax credit program. The chart here, the transfer rate for the EIP, the Energy Incentives Program, we have the one-year rate and the five-year rate, and these are the rates as determined by the Department of Energy formula.
Now, this is a discount rate you're talking about, isn't it?
Discount rate, the price that somebody would pay.
Right, thank you.
It's expressed as a percent of the face value of the tax credit. So the one-year, the blue line there, for the most part, that price has been around 97, 98, 90, 90, 99%. So a $100 tax credit would be sold for $99. The red line is the price for the five-year tax credit. And we can see here in 2012, 2013, that price was up near 100%. But for the most part, since 2013, it's been down to around 82%. It's in the low 80s. It peaked up here a little bit as we went through 2016. And lastly, we're down here around 83, 84%. Many of the projects that you're going to hear about related to House Bill 3032 were tagged with this transfer price in 2012, 2013. And that's why they're not being sold. Basically, the price is too high, and they're having trouble finding buyers at that rate because it's a five-year tax credit. So the next question I usually get is, well, how many of these tax credits are there? And this table here, the unsold tax credits by entity type, show that the conservation and transportation tax credits, as earned by private entities, government entities, and nonprofit entities. In total, there are about $44 million in tax credits. And I should note that these figures are a bit dated. These numbers might be pushing a year old now. But it's what I had on hand and gives a flavor of the magnitude here. So of the $44 million in tax credits that are stuck, so to speak, $21 million are held by by private sector entities, $22 million by government entities, and then $1.2 million held by nonprofit entities. So now we get to the two bills at hand. We have House Bill 2286, the sections on the left, and in the middle is the policy or the tax credit. And then on the right is House Bill 3032. The first part of 2286, sections 1 through 6, deal with creating a uniform transfer policy, basically saying that it doesn't matter if it's a housing tax credit, an energy tax credit, an economic development tax credit, this is how it would be transferred. I didn't get into the detail on this yet because the key point here is that all tax credits would be handled the same. There are a number of issues embedded in there that we can get to as time permits, but for right now the takeaway there is that is a first step at establishing this uniform tax policy. Some of the benefits for that are ease of understanding the tax code. So the Department of Revenue, whenever they talk to anybody, or if a CPA, whenever they talk to anybody about a transferable tax credit, this is how it's done. So there's some advantage and some argument for uniformity along those lines, just adding clarity, if you can use that term, with respect to the tax code. And then we get the remainder of the sections. I'm not sure why section 11 is blank, but for the most part, the remainder of the sections are conforming language for the different tax credits. And so 2286 is the broader policy. House Bill 3032.
Now, I'm sorry, I was wool gathering there for a minute. If we're going to get into the bills, I should probably open the public hearing, don't you think?
No.
Yes?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go back. And thank you very much for the background that you brought us up to date. And I think since you're going to discuss both of these bills right now, right, we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2286 and House Bill 3032. Now, go ahead with your discussion of these two bills.
Okay. House Bill 2286 is the broader bill. The first six sections of the bill establish a uniform transfer policy. It's a first step at doing so. And the remainder of the sections are basically conforming language for that uniform policy and information that gets transmitted to the Department of Revenue for them to administer the tax return side of the policies. House Bill 3032 touches on just the conservation and transportation tax credits and deals with the unsold tax credit problem that I just described, with tax credits that were earned but the transfer price was set high, too high. And so that's basically the shell of the bills. The remaining information I have here, we have two statutes that relate to general transferability. So this is the extent to which the legislature has decided to make broad policy on the transfer of tax credits. The first one is that tax credits may be transferred only once. And the second one applies to a handful of tax credits that can only be sold to a C corporation, an S corporation, or a personal income taxpayer. The idea behind that statute was to prevent partnerships being created for the sole purpose of siphoning out the tax credits. So that's the extent to which there are broad policies. The remainder of the section here are the specific statutes for the tax credits that are transferable in one way or another. There's more detail in the statute about information that might have to be shared with the Department of Revenue or the transfer price and so forth. But those are just statutes I put here for your convenience. And that's basically the background in hopes of providing some context for the largely technical, but technical bills you have before you, but there are significant policy considerations.
Thank you. Any questions for Chris as we go through this? I will note that he summarized in 25 minutes a topic that we have been struggling with for most of the time that any of us has been paying attention to tax credits, both to understand it, how it works, and also to make certain that the policy of the legislature is actually executable by people who don't have any tax liability for whatever reason, or, as he pointed out, for those who need to monetize their tax credits so they can use the money to complete the project that the tax credit's for. Yes, Representative Buehler, please.
Thanks, Chair Barnhart. Chris, can you explain how transportation tax credits are generated?
There are two kinds of projects. You have fleet vehicles and basically the recharging stations. And if I'm a business and I want to install a recharging station, I make that investment and then I earn that tax credit.
And how about the fleets?
The fleet is similar if I purchase a fleet of alternative fuel vehicles. So it's not for a fleet of regular vehicles.
I see. Does that include hybrids or just electric vehicles?
I believe it's just electric.
Any other questions? I think what we'll do is these two bills are in some ways, other than the fact that they're related to the same general topic, quite distinct. And I have only one witness on House Bill 2286. So let's go to the department and hear from them about the uniform transfer procedures that I assume the department would like to have.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue. And I'm here today to talk about House Bill 2286, which is a bill that we brought as an agency. And Chris did describe the couple of the provisions in there. The three significant parts that are in it is the uniformity and how tax credits are transferred, a requirement that state agencies and pass-through entities, state agencies who transfer credits, who certify credits, inform the department of the specifics of the certified credits, and uniform clawback provisions for when a taxpayer who earned a credit no longer qualifies for the credit. These changes from our point of view are administrative in nature. However, one of them does require some policy choices by the legislature to enable the administrative simplicity. The department's goal with this concept is to provide a means for the department to ensure that the taxpayer who is entitled to claim the credit claims it, and only the total amount of the certified credit and not more. We currently do this through a mixed approach of real-time processing and audit, but we want to use automation and make full use of the new tools we have in our new computer system, GenTax. Additionally, capturing this information in electronic format will provide more detailed information for forecasters, such as your RO staff, to better understand how credits are claimed in current and future years. First, Section 3 of the bill would require state agencies to inform the department of tax credits they have certified. We currently have agreements with various agencies that certify tax credits. However, all of them prefer an affirmative requirement in statute to require them to provide this information to the department. Section 3 requires agencies that certify tax credits to give us information about the value and type of the credit, as well as identifying information about who is eligible to claim the credit. This section also requires pass-through entities who earn certified credits to notify the department which of their partners or shareholders will be claiming the credit and in what amount. We will then load that information into the GenTax module we call the Business Credit Manager, or BCM. The BCM will allow us to process returns and validate certified tax credits in real time as we process the returns, rather than after the fact upon audit. Second, Section 4 of the bill provides uniform provisions for the clawback of a credit when an agency determines that the person is no longer eligible for the credit. Currently, various tax credits have different provisions for how and when a credit should be revoked. Section 4 of the bill makes it clear that there must be an order issued by the certifying agency and appealed through the contested case process under Chapter 183. Upon a final order, the department would be able to bill back the taxpayer for the amount of credit that they've already claimed that reflects the portion of the revoked or rescinded credit. If the credit was transferred, the transferee, the person who paid for the credit, would be held harmless, and the person who sold the credit, the transferor, would be the one who's billed back. Third, Section 2 of the bill, I kind of went out of order there, but Section 2 is the transferable process that has the most policy choices for you. Section 2 of the bill requires uniformity in how tax credits are transferred. Under current law, as Chris described, there are 6 credits that are currently transferable, 4 of which are scheduled to sunset this year if the legislature does not extend them. 2 of them are scheduled to sunset at the end of 2019. We think that uniformity will improve our ability to ensure these tax credits are being claimed properly and provide a better understanding of what is claimed and what is left to be claimed. The introduced version of the bill sets forth ways that transferability can be standardized, and it applies as of January 1, 2018. Since the public hearing in February, the first public hearing in February, we've had the opportunity to speak with advocates as well as other agencies about possibilities relating to the uniformity. The current version of the bill requires that a credit be transferred within 2 years from the time the credit is earned. That is in sub 3 of Section 2. It also requires that no part of the credit be used in order for it to be transferable. I believe that's in sub 4. It also prohibits interest from being paid because a credit is purchased and then claimed via an amended return. That is in sub 6. There are several policy choices that can be made on how to transfer the certified credits. The policy choices that we've identified include 6 different options, so I'll go over the different options for you to consider. Option 1 would be to allow any unused part of a credit to be transferred to another person no later than the extended due date of the return on which the credit would be claimed. An unused credit is the part of the credit that has not yet been claimed on a return, not including any carry forward amount. So a carry forward amount would not be able to be transferred. There would be no need to handle interest calculations, as the return at issue would not be amended, but rather be an original return. This option advocates believe is more favorable than the 2-year time frame in the introduced version of the bill because it makes the credits more marketable. The state agencies that administer these transferable tax credits can administer this option, and this is the department's preferred method. Option 2 would be to not require any time frame for a credit to be transferred, as long as the department is notified within 30 days of the transfer and before any transferred credit is claimed on a return. This is the option most preferred by practitioners, as it allows the most flexibility in their ability to locate purchasers of tax credits. Manual calculations of interest may still be required if a credit is sold after an original return has been filed and an amended return is needed. Option three would be adding uniform transfer timelines for all tax credits, including those scheduled to sunset, so all six of them currently. Option four would be to add a uniform timeline for CHISTA agricultural workforce credit, as that one is not scheduled to sunset this year. As Chris said, the lender's credit is also not scheduled to sunset this year, but that is not one that's sold. It just travels with the loan as the loan transfers from financial institution to financial institution. Option five would be to add a uniform transfer timeline for any credit that is newly established after the effective date of this bill. This option would allow for a transition period where existing credits might be allowed to expire, and as new credits are added, those would follow the new standard transfer provisions until all credits did follow those. And then option six would be to just provide not deal with the transferable uniformity in this bill, but just deal with the certified list that Chris mentioned, as well as the uniform clawback provisions. So I'm sure there are other options that are out there to consider, and there are probably a lot of moving parts to this. However, we recommend options one and three at this point, although we are still obviously open to conversation. We're looking for some direction from the committee. We believe that uniformity is a key in the ability to administer these credits effectively. In fact, Iowa was recently recognized by the Federation of Tax Administrators for implementing just what we are asking to do here. They will receive an award in June for working with 17 different agencies to get 13 tax credit programs into a new system they call CACTUS, Credit Award Claim and Transfer Administration System. The FTA reports that their system has the potential to improve revenue forecasting by providing detailed information on tax credit awards and their use, enabling forecasters to better understand how credits are claimed in current and future years. We ask that you give us permission to continue working with Legislative Council on amendments to reflect what options you prefer, as we have discussed above, and support our goal of uniformity in tax credit administration. With that, if you have any questions, thank you.
Thank you. I suspect there are some. Let me ask the first one. Is that material that you just were reading from in OLS?
It is not.
Provide it. Will you put it there?
You
went through a bunch of options, and it would sure be handy to be able to refer to those directly rather than from memory.
Apologize. I will provide it.
Yeah. Would you mind going through those
Certainly.
Options, especially the ones that the department prefers again?
Right. Option one would be to require the tax credit to be transferred no later than the extended due date of the return on which the credit would be claimed. For example, with the agricultural workforce credit, they have 5 years. Let's just say it's a $100,000 credit. They can take 20% of it in each of 5 years over a 10-year period. So in year one, they claim 20% of the credit, $20,000. They have a tax liability of $10,000. They have a carry forward of $10,000. In years 2 through 10, they could choose, the taxpayer could choose to sell the credit, the remaining $80,000 credit. In any one of those years, they could sell it all at once, or they could sell it year by year as time goes by, depending on their personal situation. As long as it's done before October 15th, of the year the tax return is due. So if they have a 2018 credit that they want to sell, they'd have to notify us by before October 15th of 2019 that the credit would be claimed on a 2018 return. And they have to do so within 30 days. The recommendation would be 30 days of the transfer. There's a form that they would complete with the Department of Revenue to indicate that the credit was transferred from taxpayer A to taxpayer B. That option actually streamlines some of the processes for the Department of Energy, who currently reissues certificates. They would no longer have to do that, as the taxpayer who earned the original certificate would then just complete the paperwork with the Department of Revenue, and then we would know how much credit was taxpayer A was entitled to and taxpayer B was entitled to. So that's option one. Have the credit be able to be sold no later than the extended due date for the return on which the credit would be claimed. So in any 1 year, year by year, the carry forward would be, or excuse me, the tax credit would be able to be sold.
Now, that could be done all at once at the beginning.
It could be done all at once. You're right, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Or it could be done year by year as the taxpayer decides. That does increase flexibility over the current process.
Yes, where you can only do one transfer, in many of these tax credits.
Yes.
Yeah. I hesitate to ask this, but I'm going to anyway. How does what you're proposing differ from the law today?
Mr. Chair, I'm not expert on the...
It's a mess, isn't it?
It is a mess. It's difficult for us to explain how different... I know the biomass credit has to be done within the before the due date.
They're all different, aren't they?
Every single one of them is different.
They're all different.
Yeah.
All right.
So that's our goal.
Why don't you go ahead with the next? I apologize for asking the question.
That's fine.
Let's go to the next one.
So our option three that we wanted, option one and option three. Option one was the due date, the extended due date, and then option three would have that be applying to all five of the transferable tax credits, because the lender's one again does not get sold in the same sense that the other five do. So we would want the credit that to apply to all of them. We understand that the four energy credits are scheduled to sunset, and they may or may not be extended, and there would be some transition period that the Department of Energy and our agency would be able to work through on that final year. But we think that we can work through those. Those are what we would like to see. I think the practitioner community would like to not have any time frame on transferring the tax credit. That makes it easier for them to sell, identify a purchaser, more time to do so. That would be option two. And then, of course, option four would be for you to just address the agricultural workforce credit, which is just the one credit that's it can be taken over 19 years. It's a 10-year, it can be taken over 10 years with a 9-year carry forward, so the tail can go out to 19 years. And then option five would be to only apply it to newly established credits, leave the current transferable ones alone, but as you guys choose to add new ones, have them required to follow the new standard procedures. Of course, that doesn't help us right now with the six or the five that we have that we're trying to straighten up now, but certainly it would be something that we could do going forward. And then the final option would be to just not deal with the transferable component in this bill, but just to deal with the list of certified credits from the other agencies, as well as the standardized clawback provisions. But okay. We would prefer the first option with the due date October 15th, the transfer before October 15th, and have it apply to all of the transferable credits.
Thank you. I think that's our signal to have a conversation about what the different options are that we ought to do. Representative Vance?
Well, if we're going to have that conversation, I'll just wait. Is there
You have other things you want to ask questions?
Well, yeah,
please, go ahead.
Thank you. I just am curious, the option one, from your standpoint, the most significant change is what from current transfer rules? What's the big thing that's changing in your first option that is going to make everybody that's got one of these things angry and upset?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Vance, the change actually would be from the introduced version of 2286, and that required all tax credits to be sold within 2 years in sub 3 of section 2, all within 2 years from the original due date of the return. And our partner agencies said that was a significant change from their current practices, and they were not they would not support that change, in particular with the agricultural workforce housing credit, because the length of time that it needs to be, it can be taken over 10 years. So we came to the table, met with our partner agencies to see if there was an alternative that we could live with, that the practitioner community could live with, and everyone came to the option one that we suggested, which would be a change from this 2286. And forgive me, I'm not familiar with the existing transferable, other than I know they're all different.
Yeah, please.
Oh, yeah, the underlying concept of shortening the period of time within which the credit could be transferred was what? Why did you want to do this?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bentz, I know for when we first put this concept forward, we were working with LC, and we said we'll just put something in there just to start the conversation. We were not tied to it in any way, shape, or form. It does actually extend it quite a bit for the biomass credit, which I believe is just a third. You have to have it transferred by the due date of the original return. So it was just a point to start the conversation of making it uniform for all the credits and to get people to the table to say what works for them.
Yeah, please.
Right, well, of course, the challenge is to make sure that whatever it was that we thought we were doing to incent, whatever activity we're trying to incent, is not being in any way damaged by virtue of whatever rules we now adopt. So that's really the question, isn't it? So my fear would be on any of these that somehow we're doing something that is inconsistent with the original concept and offer, if you will. Mm-hmm. So are we relying upon people to come forward, practitioners mainly, to tell us what they think the consequences of the changes might be? Is that who's going to step up and say, oh my goodness, or are we not going to learn about that until after we've made the change?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Vince, we've been in contact with Moss Adams in Portland. They're one of the biggest practitioners that deal with transferable tax credits that we know of. And they have, I believe, provided testimony. They are also not in support of having a time frame on there. If you look at their testimony, I do believe that they suggest that. But the rest of the concept they are supportive of. I don't know when the timing would be that they would presumably as a taxpayer is affected by the change, would they come forward with it? Because we can't know ahead of time.
Yeah, please. Yeah,
so most of these have a life, if you will, within the original design, mm-hmm. a design life, we'll call it. But we're in this process trying to change that design life to make all of the design lives the same of these particular devices. Is that a correct statement? Mm-hmm. But we're wending our way through a bunch of different approaches to these credits, mm-hmm. and trying to get them all the same. The real question is, can we look back and do that? Have we encountered any suggestion from, I haven't read the Moss Adams report, but are they saying, yes, you can do this and not do damage to those who've relied upon the original, I'm going to say, offer?
Mr. Chair and Representative Vance, I don't believe that this would damage anyone's original offer. If the credit's already been transferred and sold, then those provisions are currently applying. This would apply to transfers that occur on or after January 1 of 2018. So they would have that window of time to sell the portion of credit. The only portion of the policy choice that the department is asking you to make as far as uniformity goes is about the transferability of it. We have no issues with the pricing or any of the other policy choices that you have underneath all of the different various credits. The 10 years, like for example, the housing credit, that it's taken 5 years over a 10-year period and a 9-year carry forward. We can administer that. That's not an issue at all. 3-year carry forward, depending, all of those provisions are fine. We don't have issues with that. It's simply uniform provisions in transferring it and how we get notified of that transfer, so we can ensure that taxpayer A is claiming no more than what taxpayer A has been certified for.
Sure, this is bringing back memories of the, yeah, okay, it's all coming back slowly.
You thought you'd blocked it. Yes,
I understand the motivation for that. Yes. Having been there myself, Representative Marsh, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make sure that I understood what you said correctly. So the uniformity bill does not suggest any uniformity around the price setting issue.
Not the Mr. Chair and Representative Marsh, not the Department of Revenue's bill.
Okay.
We did not suggest that.
Thank you.
Representative Buehler, please.
If we put a 2-year time limit on transfer of the tax credit, what would that generally do to the valuation of the tax credits?
Mr. Chair and Representative Buehler, my understanding is that it would make them less marketable, so the price would be driven down. That's what the advocates are telling us. That's why we would suggest option one, which would be to allow them to sell it at any time before the extended due date of the year in which they plan to claim the credit.
Does that actually extend the time they can sell it now?
Mr. Chair, I believe it does on some of the credits. It definitely does on the biomass credit. The biomass credit has to be sold before the due date of the return in which it's going to be claimed. The original due date, I believe that's April 15th.
Okay, so you're actually giving them 6 more months.
in that particular case.
That particular case.
Yes.
But I mean, if I were to buy a tax credit that is a year old, couldn't I simply file an amended return for that year and ask you to pay me back?
Mr. Chair, so
I should say to ask the department to pay me back.
That is one of the options that we would consider. But if that's the case, we would ask that the.
No, I mean under the current law.
Under current law.
Yeah.
I believe that is not how it works in the energy credits. I wish someone was here from there, but
I
believe that they certify the credit. If it was earned in 2014, they wait for the credit until it is eligible to be, until it's actually sold, and then they issue a certificate for tax year 2017. And then that's the year in which the taxpayer claims the credit if the purchase was made in 2017. So there wouldn't be an amending in that case.
Okay. So if I understand you right, your option one in all cases would either be the same as or extending the current deadline.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Okay. So the Moss Adams comment in which they say putting conditions on the amount of time one has to transfer these incentives only places more risk and uncertainty on the transfer process. Uncertainty in the tax credit world drives credit prices down, which ultimately delivers less cash to the project owner. Those two sentences would be less true under option one than under the current law, if we all understand it correctly. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I believe that is correct, as well as the introduced version of 2286 that has the two-year limit.
That has the two-year limit. Mm-hmm. And that would the two-year limit would apply to the whole thing.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And the extended out years in addition to the first 2 years.
Yes.
I got you. Thank you. Did that answer your question, Representative Bueller?
So existing policy is 2 years?
No. Mr. Proposed. Chair and Representative Bueller, existing policy is different for every single credit. In 2286, we took, when we were drafting, we said we have to choose something. Let's go with 2 years. It's below the 3-year statute of limitations to amend a return, to file an amended return, and it gives them more time to, you know, do the work that they need to do to find a purchaser. But it was just the conversation starter.
What happens with lawmaking, and I don't think it's peculiar to Oregon, I think it happens everywhere, is that you pass some laws that are based on things you'd like to see happen, and later on you come back and you figure out that there's a relationship among several of those that happened over different years, and then you come back and try to regularize it. And I think that's where we are. I think that's where we are today on this particular topic. Looking back, it doesn't make any of us look very good that we didn't see it, 7 or 8 years ago. But we didn't, and so now it's at least the department seems to think it's now time.
With that, we would like to see what your opinion is as a committee, and then request permission to work with legislative council to draft amendment to conform to whatever your policy choices are.
All right. Is that something we can do here, or do I need to set up a short-term small work group to work on it? And if so, who would like to serve on that little work group?
Representative Bueller.
I mean, I can work with the department, but you may not like what the department and I come up with.
We do have a member who's absent, which is always a good way to staff one of those
Let a freshman do it.
Representative Benz?
Yeah, I'll volunteer for
You're willing to work on it?
Are you really?
Representative Marsh? Why don't the two of you see if you and the department can get together on this, taking into account the criticisms that the accounting firm has, Moss Adams, and see if you can come up with something that looks like it is uniform, making it easy to administer, and is most likely not to run into the risk that Moss Adams was talking about, and other concerns that you come up with. How's that? Is that okay? Why don't we do that? We'll set up that work group. We'll ask them to meet with you and whoever you want from the department, maybe from the Department of Energy.
And housing.
And housing. Yes. And come back to us as quickly as may be with the amendment you want. Is that okay? All right. Okay. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on House Bill 2286? They're all smart enough not to. All right. Representative Hernandez, please.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you already may have done this, but have you done stakeholder outreach to the folks who would be impacted by these changes? Particularly, I'm interested to know if, like, the affordable housing folks have been part of this process and what their input has been in these changes.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hernandez, they're here in the room today, and they are supportive of our option one, which would be to allow the credit to be sold at each of each year as year by year goes by.
Okay, thank you. And would this work group work with these stakeholders?
Yes.
I think that's the plan. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah, and it'll be the work group product. I mean, whatever they come up with, that's what we'll consider next. No guarantees we're going to pass anything at all, but if we can devise something that most of the people think will work, then we probably ought to consider it seriously.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chair, just to add to that, if we can't land on something that's uniform for transferable provisions, we would still like to see the requirement that agencies give us a list of certified tax credits and provide uniform clawback provisions, which is also in 2286 in sections 2 and 4, to go forward without.
Would you take another minute and explain those provisions?
So in section 2 of the bill, let me get to the bill, actually. Section 2 of the bill requires that agencies that certify any tax credit provide information to us mm-hmm. about the tax credit. Oh, excuse me, not section 2. Section 3, I apologize. Section 3 of the bill requires a state agency to tell us who they've certified a credit to so that we can put it into our new system. It's called a business credit manager, so that we can turn, when we process returns, we can tell in real time that you've earned a credit and that the value of it is X. And then we can process the return rather than do it as an audit function after the fact. So that is section 3 of the bill. It would also require pass-through entities to share with information with us about their shareholders. So if they earned a credit, the entity earned a credit, and they have 500 shareholders that they've divvied that credit up amongst, then they need to tell us who those shareholders are and what portion of the credit they are entitled to, so we can automate that in our business credit manager. That's a new tool that we have available to us in our new system, GenTax.
Okay.
Section 4 of the bill provides that all of the different statutes have clawback provisions, which means if the taxpayer no longer qualifies or for some reason doesn't do what they're supposed to do, that the agency generally has the ability, each of the certifying agencies generally have the ability to revoke or suspend that credit. So what we're hoping for here is that at the point in time there is a final order for the revocation that's been appealed through the Office of Administrative Hearings and through that court process, that we then can issue a bill based on that final order and collect from the person who originally earned the credit. Now, if the credit has been sold, we would hold the person who purchased the credit harmless because they actually paid cash, they paid for the credit. We would look to bill back the transfer or the person who sold the credit. So that would be the uniform. So that would allow us to just issue a bill and start collecting on the amount based on that final order.
Okay. And does that generate any more questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question's not on that topic, but you mentioned ag workforce housing earlier. And in reading through sections 9 and so forth, I don't see any changes in the years that the owner can use that tax credit against subsequent incomes. Is that correct? None of that changes. They still have, I think, up to 10 years.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, that is correct. We are not asking to change any of the underlying provisions about the policy choices about the specific credits other than how they transfer it.
Good. Thank you.
And there are a bunch of Scrivener corrections in that section, as you probably noticed.
I see those.
Yeah. All right. Anything else? Anything else you want to tell us on this bill today?
Thank you for your time and considering it.
Thank you. Thank you very much. All right. I think I can close that public hearing House Bill 2286, and we'll continue the public hearing on House Bill 3032. Did you want to tell us anything more about it? I know we've got a dash one.
This next one is much simpler. It deals with the conservation.
You think interest. It is?
Yes. Well.
Sorry.
I probably spoke too soon.
Yeah, go on, Chris.
A different set of problems.
Yes.
Different set of challenges. The conservation and transportation tax credits, there is a backlog of tax credits that for which the transfer price was set by the Department of Energy as per statute, and that price is too high and they can't be sold, so they're kind of stuck. And what the drafted bill does is offer a way to change that price. And then you also have, we just got a dash one amendment, which I believe limits that policy to government and nonprofit tax, basically tax exempt entities.
Right, and that came from the League of Oregon Cities, I believe. And Wendy Johnson can explain that more to us, assuming she's seen it, before. It has my name on it, which I think illustrates the weakness in the new rule requiring names, the member's name be on an amendment, because it really is something where I gave a note to ask the amendment to be drafted. Go ahead, anything else?
Well, the detail is that under current law, the price has to be determined at when the project receives its pre-certification. These projects go through a pre-certification process where stakeholders go to the Department of Energy, say they propose a project, and the department certifies it, saying, okay, here's your pre-cert. Then the entity goes out, performs the project, and when it's done, they come back to the department and you get a final certification. And that can be months or a year and a half apart. And the timing of the tax credit under current law, that timing is set at the beginning of the process at pre-cert. And the way 3032 is drafted is that it could be either that pre-cert price or the price determined at final certification. And that can make as per that chart, the timing can make a difference.
Right, you're following your chart. There's quite a discount available at the time of final certification if it's tomorrow.
Correct.
As compared to those times where the two lines intersect.
Correct.
Several years ago. All right. Let's start with Wendy Johnson, who can come and explain this amendment, and then I've got three other people, and I think you might as well all come at once. Stan Primozich, Dale Penn, Michael Ray, perhaps. You may have to pull up another chair.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. I think staff has explained the issues. I'll just go through the reason we needed an amendment as well. There are really four issues. First is the rate. As Chris explained, the rate for some of our entities, cities, counties, special districts, school districts, military department, et cetera, the rate just is so high that it's not sellable. And so both the underlying bill and the amendments would say you can use either time frame, either the pre-cert date or the final cert date, to pick your rate, so that hopefully that will make it sellable. The second issue and the reason for the amendment is that for the energy credits, you get a pre-cert, and that cert is only good for 3 years. And unfortunately, the underlying bill doesn't deal with that problem. You have 3 years essentially to get your project done. So on the previous bill, you talked about transferability and when you have to get your credit transferred. Well, there's not a transfer date per se with these two tax credits. It's you've got 3 years to get your project done, or you can't get your credit and sell it if you need to transfer it. So we're trying to just get that group of tax credits in that bad window of bad rates to allow their pre-cert to be extended, because 3 years it's done, and you still have 5 years to use the tax credit, but the pre-cert is now expired, and so you can't even get the tax credit. So that's what's in the amendment, is saying those pre-certs that were issued in the 2012 to 2014 window will be extended. Then the third issue is the tax credit itself has to be used in 5 years or for five tax years. And so some projects are done, some are almost done, and some are done and have expired pre-cert. So we're trying to deal with all three of those types of fact patterns. And you need to extend the sunset of the use of the tax credit itself so that those 5 years can be used. But then the ones that are still in progress, they still have their 3 years. So we need a total of eight to get it finished. And then the last issue is the who. Because this is a tough revenue year, we decided in the amendment to ask that you just narrow it to the nonprofits and the government entities, because they're the ones who have to transfer their tax credit to ever use it. And so that will lower the revenue impact to the $22 million, and then you divide it over the number of years. So then you're looking at around, what, $4 to $5 million a year, which will help a whole lot more in ways and means. So that's why we've tried to narrow it down. So the basic gist, I've explained the amendments. The Department of Energy has had these tax credits on the books that they were setting the rate since 2012. And when these come out, they're advertised, they're marketed essentially to, you know, try to incentivize you to do these things. And there was a whole oversight committee during the interim to talk about the Department of Energy and this particular program. And so it was made clear on the record that mistakes were made, promises were made of how this program would work, and they just haven't come to fruition. So this is really a correction that we need to make for cities and counties and special districts whole. And so we'd ask for your support of that, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. And then I think we're going to hear from three of the people who used the credit, I think.
Hi, this is Dale Penn. I'm here representing Salem Kaiser Transit. So just for a little bit of background, first of all, Wendy did a fantastic job providing an overview of the bill, the amendment language that we're asking for. Salem Kaiser Transit, or Chariots, is the fixed route transit provider in the Salem Kaiser and Marion Polk County area. In addition, Chariots operates the Chemeketa Area Regional Transportation System, or CARTS, out to our rural communities. What you see up on the screen is a letter that both Chariots and the Association of Oregon Counties and Wendy's League of Oregon Cities have authored, outlining our concerns and our support for the bill itself. Chariots is also the transit provider for seniors and people with disabilities in the area. Through the Chairlift service, the Red Line Shopper, the Dial-A-Ride. Without Chariots providing these vital opportunities for our most vulnerable populations, many would not have the ability to shop for food, attend a medical appointment, or accomplish many of the necessities that we take for granted. Salem Kaiser Transit has two tax credits that they acquired in the 2012 and 13 tax years, and they fall right in that blip, as Chris indicated, of pricing structure that make the tax credits completely unsellable. These were credits related to energy saving investments they made in services, infrastructure, and operations. So the amendments, I believe, do everything that we want this bill to accomplish. We haven't had a chance to review them yet, but we're hoping to. As Wendy had indicated, we did our best to limit the impact of the amendments to nonprofits, government entities, and whatnot, in order to restrict the budget impact. She also mentioned the Department of Energy Oversight Committee, which met during the interim. Representative Bentz was on that committee. Part of our testimony included the Department of Energy Oversight Report, which is, I think, a 12 or 13 page document. On page 11 in particular, it mentions the changes that we're discussing here, the recommendations that group made to statutory changes to address this concern that we're bringing forward to you right now. I just wanted to make sure that in an environment where transit districts, schools, local governments, they're struggling to secure adequate funding to serve their communities. They've relied on programs like this in order to help offset some of the investments they've made in energy saving and programs. Just wanted to mention several of the entities that currently have these tax credits and the entities we're trying to address the problem for. Power School District in Coos County, Morrow County School District in Morrow County, Lowell School District in Lane, Yamhill County, the City of Gresham, Tigard, Portland, the Oregon Military Department, which made investments in Milton Freewater, Warrenton, several other locations in the state, and, of course, Salem-Keizer Transit. So these are just some of the entities that are impacted by the decisions we face here today. So we urge you to support the bill, and we're here to answer any questions you may have.
Please, sir. Yes.
Yes. Chairman Barnhart and members of the committee, my name is Stan Primozich. I am the chair of the Yamhill Board of Commissioners, Yamhill County. And I'm here to put a face with a very serious problem Yamhill County has. We're a rural county. We are in need of transit dollars so we can service our vulnerable populations. And the reason we entered into this program with the Department of Energy was to provide some additional funding to update our very, very dilapidated transit system. Our buses are over 60% of them are well past their usable life. And these dollars, our funding for buying buses comes from federal grants. And these dollars are what we use as our match to get those buses. And it's critical to us in our community with the tax revenue we have. We entered into this program with the idea that this would be beneficial to our county. It's turned out to be a real drawback for our county. The price that was set at pre-certification, as you're well aware, back 2012-2014 time period, was significantly out of proportion to what was marketable. In fact, the benefit to somebody purchasing our credit would be approximately $17,000, and it would cost them about $30,000 in fees to actually get the credit. So you can understand it's not in the best interest of anybody to buy these credits as they're currently priced. So we're just asking that this committee take seriously how this problem. We also, because the Department of Energy was undergoing some managerial changes, we were told we needed to get our final certification on this. We were running out of time. We ponied up another $23,000 to get our final certification, and then we're told that we had about 10 days to get a partner because our credits were disappearing. So we need this to be done, and we need to be done retroactively, or our credits are completely gone. So I really thank you for your time today. I don't have a lot to add. My fellow panel here have definitely given the overall picture. So thank you very much for allowing me the time to speak.
Thank you. Yes, sir. Get you close enough to the mic so that gets you on the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Michael Ray, and I am the transit director for Columbia County Rider in Columbia County, just north of the Portland metro area. And excuse me, I'm really new to this whole program. I've only been the director for just over a month, 2 months, and I've just found out about this last week. But I did a little research, and Columbia County was received a tax credit in the amount of approximately $288,000 in the 2012-2013 time period. So our pass-through rate is the 98.57%. My predecessor was unable to sell this tax credit during her entire tenure from 2012 onward, and so. We are in the same boat as Yamhill County. We rely on programs like this to help us meet our match requirements for federal grants. Columbia County Rider is dependent on more than 70% of its operating revenue provided by federal and state grants. And this program would have allowed us to match those federal grants to provide expanded service for predominantly for our senior and disabled population, but also to expand our fixed route service serving the general population of Columbia County. So I'm just here to support the amendments and hopefully lower the pass-through rate so we can get our tax credit sold.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. Dale, comment, you mentioned school districts struggling with adequate funding, and, you know, part of my angst with what we've done on the tax credit front over the course of the last number of years is issue full-face tax credits to non-tax-paying entities like the folks you represent, but then ultimately redeemed, you know, the state ends up getting pennies on the dollar, and it takes money out of the state school fund, which ultimately means there's fewer dollars for ongoing costs. I'm not, you know, coming down on you, but I think that's part of the problem here, is that's why I think as we go forward, we have to really have, I mean, it'd be better for the state just to issue flat grants of some sort, some known commodity or denomination, rather than a tax credit that, you know, again, whatever the market bears, and the person that can redeem it against their tax liability obviously gets the full face value. So the system itself, I don't think, was well constructed. I mean, why we're incentivizing issuing tax credits to non-tax-paying entities anyway doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but that's a different question. So just some comments, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I mean, my sense is that most of those criticisms are quite appropriate. I'm interested in knowing what you've done to adjust to the fact that you haven't been able to sell these credits. What's happened? How have you adjusted to this?
We have to tap other sources, which makes it difficult for us to provide services in other areas. It's like any other entity. We have to come up with a budget, and we have to we're expected to provide certain services, and obviously the most vulnerable of our citizens are the ones that we are trying desperately to serve, and they are the ones that we have the hardest time completing those services when we don't have dollars like this. We've been making those adjustments, but we've been, in talking to the Department of Energy, they told us the only way we could get a fix was through the legislature. We're here to plead with you to take care of getting us a fix, because we're in truly in dire straits. We had $1 million in tax credit, and that's a lot of money to a county like Yamhill.
Mm-hmm. Sure it is.
Thank you.
Yeah. We've had to postpone a lot of the improvements that we were going to implement and rely on other sources and hopefully be successful in our grant applications. And luckily, we have been a little bit successful in grant applications. So, but the money that this program would allow us to be better prepared for the matching the federal grants that we do get, because the money that we receive from the county and the local jurisdictions within our jurisdiction just doesn't add up to enough. And we have had in the past, in 2012, as a matter of fact, we've had to turn back grant money because we didn't have local dollars to match.
Thank you.
So, Representative Barnhart, members of the committee, I think for Salem-Keizer Transit's perspective, my panelists from Yamhill County raised some really excellent points around lack of ability to provide additional services to vulnerable populations like seniors and people with disability. In addition, I think for Salem-Keizer Transit, the desire to phase out aging bus fleet, replacement buses is a significant investment that they would like to make, and as well as capital investments in like a South Salem Transit hub, and those kind of services are put on hold or at least pushed out as without a resolution for this kind of issue.
Thank you. Other questions?
Just a comment.
Representative Buehler, please.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Just a comment listening to today's testimony. It makes me increasingly concerned about the low carbon fuel standard and another very complex tax credit scheme that will be coming online over the next few years. So word of wisdom listening to this today, that we've bought into another complex tax credit scheme that may have serious unintended effects.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3032. colleagues, if we're ready, I'd like to go on to the work session. So we'll open the work session on House Bill 2283. Christine, why don't you let me cable this in, and then you explain what that measure does.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2283 would provide that if a taxpayer elects to apply their overpayment of tax to a subsequent year for the estimated tax installment, the amount paid is credited as of the estimated tax on the later of the first estimated tax due date or the date the payment's made. So it's a question of the who has the use of the money. So the it simply brings that into alignment with the date that it was actually paid. And so the measure is found to have minimal revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Great. What's your pleasure? Representative Vance?
You have a question?
I have a question.
Please.
Donna Bleiler, I hope that's I'm pronouncing it correctly, had a question about this. And I don't know, Christine, if you had a chance to look at her letter or not. I read it a couple of times over the weekend and finally decided that I disagreed with her, but I wasn't sure. So I was hoping you had seen it. And if not, then perhaps, Mr. Chair, I'm ready to support the bill, but I sure wish I understood what she was saying.
Right, and that letter is the second to the last item in the meeting materials for those who would like to take a look at it. My sense of it is that the writer probably doesn't understand what the bill actually does, but I'm willing to have my opinion changed if we have information to the contrary.
Mr. Chair, I would maybe request a little more time to review what she's saying exactly.
All right. Shall we go on to the other items and then come back to this one? Or Representative Vance?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would suggest if possible we carry this over until tomorrow.
All right.
And then that would give time to look at it over.
That makes sense to me. We'll carry the work session on House Bill 2283 over till tomorrow. Make a note, Paul. And we'll close the work session today on House Bill 2283 and open the work session on House Bill 2284.
Okay.
Go ahead and we'll talk about that one.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, House Bill 2284 has an amendment with it, the dash one, which simply clarifies language, really doesn't substantively change the measure, but it expands the provisions for resolution of conflicting claims to taxpayer dependents to include conflicting claims to other items allowed under personal income tax laws. So it simply allows the department to compare information from various parties and also to disclose that's been compared when finding fact related to the owing of taxes. And so the measure is found to have no revenue impact and also a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay. Have you had a chance to read that? All right. Representative Vance?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2284.
Representative Vance moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2284. Is there discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, it's so ordered. Representative Vance?
Chair, I move House Bill 2284 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Vance moves House Bill 2284 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objections to the motion? Seeing none, it's so ordered. Who would like to carry? We haven't gotten to that one yet. Don't all speak at once. All right, I'll carry that one. Somebody else will carry the next one if we get to it. House Bill, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2284. And open a work session on House Bill 2285. Give us the explanation on that one, please.
Sure. House Bill 2285 also has a dash one amendment for similar reasons to clarify language. And it provides that if a taxpayer files a report or return, but they pay less than the full amount of tax due, the tax would be assessed on the later of the original due date of the report or return. And so that would mean that it was assessed at the time that they filed the return and without regard for extension of time for filing or the date filed. The measure is found to have minimal revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
All right. Everyone had a chance to review this one. Representative Benz?
Sure. I move the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2285.
Representative Benz moves the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2285. Any discussion? Objection to the motion? Seeing none, it's so ordered. Representative Benz?
Sure. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2285 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Benz moves House Bill 2285 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Any objection to the motion? Okay. Motion carries. Goes to the floor. Who would like to carry this one? Representative Johnson, would you carry this one?
I'd be honored, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Johnson will carry it.
Thanks, Mr. Vice Chair, for the recommendation.
And with that, we'll close the work session of House Bill 2285. Paul, we've completed the business of the day, and I did carry over that other work session, did I? Okay. All right. Thank you all. We'll see you tomorrow. Committee's adjourned. Perfect.